Okay, I'd like to introduce Dr. Monica Hurdle. She's really very well known for some really pioneering work on the cortex. And there's some fantastic connections between Riemannian geometry, circle packing, tessellations in the plane, and parametric modeling of the cortex. And I think her group at Florida State have really been pioneers in understanding how the geometry of the cortex can be optimally modeled. So we're quite honored to have her here today to tell us a little bit about that. Thanks, Monica.
Thanks, Paul. I'd like to thank Paul and the organizers again for such a great meeting, and also for being so flexible, because as I think all of you know, I was supposed to speak on Monday and had a flight delay, so I appreciate the change in the program. So today I'm going to talk to you about cortical mapping using conformal geometry. So I'm going to begin with an outline of what conformal means, where conformal, different conformal methods that are used, and then particularly the method that my group is using at Florida State University called circle packing. Excuse me. So generally we can think of conformal maps as preserving angles and angle sense, meaning angle direction, where an angle between two curves is the angle between the tangent lines of those two intersecting curves. Conformal maps are commonly displayed showing that 90-degree angles are preserved, and I'll show an example of that in a moment. And these mappings are most commonly thought of in the complex plane. So here's an example of a conformal map in the complex plane. And so this is the conformal mapping here. Z maps to e to the z. And so as you can see, the lines are displayed in two different colors, showing that 90-degree angles are preserved. Now, we're not saying anything about length or area, so those things are definitely distorted, but angles and angle directions are preserved. And so for conformal mapping, f is an analytic function, so meaning that the derivative exists and is not equal to zero, and so the Cauchy-Riemann equations are satisfied. So we have this mapping function here, and so then you get two differential equations, which are known as the Cauchy-Riemann equations. So in terms of conformal mapping, there's a number of theorems which are very important, the most important one being the Riemann mapping theorem, which Riemann proved in the 1850s. And basically this theorem says there exists a unique conformal mapping up to conformal automorphisms from any Riemannian surface to the Euclidean plane, the hyperbolic disk, or sphere. So what this is telling us in non-mathematical terms is that conformal maps exist and they're mathematically unique. So the mathematically unique property is one of the really nice properties that we're interested in, because that allows us to define canonical coordinate systems. So here's a schematic showing a mapping from the Euclidean plane to the hyperbolic disk. I'll talk more about hyperbolic geometry a bit later. But so what we're doing here in this type of mapping is preserving angles. So now, generally, conformal mapping comes out of pure mathematics or conformal analysis, and so we're talking about in the continuous setting. So of course, when we move to data, like MRI data, we now move to the discrete setting. And so it's important to note that discrete conformal mapping has some subtle differences than continuous conformal mapping. And so for our purposes here, what we're going to consider our Riemann surface to be in the discrete setting is a piecewise flat, simply connected surface that is topologically equivalent to a two-sphere or a disk. And since our Riemann surface from the Riemann mapping theorem theoretically conformal maps onto any proper simply connected region, the complex plane, the hyperbolic disk, or a sphere, we can extend that into the discrete setting as well. So what do we mean, though, in the discrete setting? If you think of a surface that has curvature that's embedded in three-space and you want to move it into two-space, right, how can you possibly preserve angles? Because you're going to have angles with positive curvature and angles with negative curvature and angles with zero curvature, and in the plane you have zero curvature everywhere. So we use the concept of angle proportion or angle rescaling. So what we do is the angle at a vertex in our original surface maps so that it's rescaled to be the correct proportion in the plane. So we can define with our triangulated mesh, if this is just a schematic of a mesh, this could be embedded in three space. So the angle sum is the sum of the angles given at a vertex. And so what we are doing is we're mapping a surface embedded in R3 conformally to the plane, which corresponds to the idea, like I said, of preserving angle proportion. So a particular angle like theta I, so an angle here in the original surface, would be scaled to the correct proportion in the plane. So when we talk about flattening surfaces in terms of brain mapping or other applications, and we talk about conformal mapping, what do we mean by a flat surface? Well, we tend to talk about a surface of constant curvature. So we have three main types of settings that we can consider. We have the Euclidean plane, which we identify with the complex plane, and there the curvature is zero everywhere. We have the unit disk, which we use the hyperbolic disk model, the Poincaré hyperbolic disk model, and with this model, curvature is -1 everywhere. And then on the unit sphere is our third setting, and there we have constant curvature of +1 everywhere. And so why are we interested in conformal mapping in particular? Well, it's impossible to flatten a surface with intrinsic curvature without introducing metric or aerial distortions. This is often known as the mapmaker's problem. Sailors knew this way back when, hundreds of years ago, and so that's why certain projections of the Earth are actually conformal maps, one of the famous ones being the Mercator projection. So in the last sort of 5 years or so, a number of conformal mapping methods have appeared on the scene in terms of computational implementations. Most of them are numerical methods where you're solving some sort of PDE or some sort of equation or minimizing. So we have PDE methods for solving the Cauchy-Riemann equations. We have harmonic energy minimization methods for solving the Laplace-Beltrami equation. And then we also have differential geometric methods based on the approximation of holomorphic differentials. Some of these have come out of Paul's group here at UCLA. Others have come out of like Georgia Tech. And so these are sort of generally in the last 5 to 10 years. The method, though, that I'm going to focus on today is a circle packing method. And this is really the first realization, the computational realization of the Riemann mapping theorem. It came about probably about 20 years ago now. It was first proposed by Thurston. And this idea is to use circle packings to find a conformal map. So because before this method sort of came about, it was easy to compute conformal maps of very simple surfaces, but complex surfaces that had high curvature and high folding was very, very difficult to compute conformal maps of. So some terminology to introduce circle packing. We have a triangulated surface, so that in our case could be our brain surface. And our triangulated surface embedded in three space can be described in terms of what we call its two complex, K, so that's just how the vertices are connected, and then the location of the vertices, V, in three space. And what we're trying to do with conformal mapping is find a bijection that defines each point in our surface, our original surface, T, with a corresponding point in our conformal map, T prime, where the combinatorics, or the complex, stays the same, but we now have new vertex locations. And so we're going to talk about our circle packing P, and it's going to occur in a geometric space, so that will be our Euclidean plane, our hyperbolic disk, or our sphere, and it's a collection of circles with a specified pattern of tangencies. So generally speaking, here we have some sort of triangulation, so our complex is the connectivity of the vertices, and V is the location of the vertices in three space, and so we get a corresponding circle packing P. And essentially what we're doing is for every vertex in our triangulated surface, we have a corresponding circle in our packing. And we have the conditions such that if two vertices are tangent, or form an edge in our triangulated surface, those circles are ultimately going to be tangent in our circle packing. And of course, we also add the idea that we preserve orientation, so three vertices which are counterclockwise in our original surface will be counterclockwise in our packing. Also with our packing, we associate a label R to each vertex. Typically that consists of, we consider that to be the radii of our circles. So we have one radius for each vertex. What we'll also do is we're going to talk about a little bit later the special case where we have the radii on the boundaries. So some other theorems which make the link between circle packing and conformal maps, we have the Andreev, Thurston, Kobe theorem. Basically, this theorem says that any triangulation of the two-sphere may be realized by a tangency packing of circles. So each vertex corresponds to a circle, and so then if we have two vertices which form an edge in our surface, they'll be tangent in their in the circle packing. And this packing is unique up to Möbius transformations. So this is telling us that our circle packing is unique. Then we have the discrete uniformization theorem. And basically, this theorem tells us that the circle packing is equivalent to a conformal map of that surface. So we have our complex, which is a topological surface, and we have our Riemann surface. This M is in bold. That's homeomorphic to our topological surface in a circle packing. And we have spherical, hyperbolic, or Euclidean metrics, and the Riemannian surface is unique up to conformal equivalence and is unique up to conformal automorphisms. And so this is related to the circle packing, and so this is telling us that our circle packing for our surface exists from the previous theorem and is conformally equivalent to that surface. And lastly, we have the circle packing theorem. And basically, this tells us, again, of how to compute the circle packing and that it's unique, so that given any abstract triangulation with positive numbers of our radii assigned, in this case, we're specifically only concerned with the radii assigned to the boundary. This tells us there's a unique circle packing in the plane, so that the whatever radius you assign to those circles on are the vertices on the boundary, so that packing label will be preserved in your circle packing. So that could be that radius you assign or want to be preserved on your boundary of the circle packing. It could just be some arbitrary number, some theoretical number. For our brain maps, we use it to actually be the edge length of the data coming out of the cortical surfaces. It could be some other feature that you might be interested in. Alternatively, which I'll explain a little bit later, one of the nice things about circle packing is instead of specifying a variable for the boundary vertices, we can specify the shape that we want our circle packing map to appear. Because with a conformal map, it's conformal on the interior of the map. It's not conformal on the boundary. So we can also specify a shape to map our conformal map to, such as a rectangle. So to compute a discrete conformal mapping with circle packing, these three theorems, the discrete uniformization theorem, the circle packing theorem, and the ring lemma, which is a consequence of the circle packing theorem, guarantee that our circle packing is unique and quasi-conformal, and we say it's quasi because this discrete packing will converge to the conformal map in the limit. Typically, we only do one iteration. So given a simply connected triangulated surface, again, we have our three vertices. What we're going to do is we're trying to compute the circles, the radii of the circles, such that we specified the radius of our circles, what we want our circles to be on the boundary, which corresponds to the edge length of our surface. And then we want to compute the radii of the circles, and we have the condition such that if two vertices form an edge in our triangulation, those circles must be tangent to each other. And we also require orientation to be preserved. So the original algorithm that we've been using for the last few years is an iterative algorithm that's been proven to converge. And it essentially uses the idea of surface curvature, which is concentrated at the vertices of our triangulation. And if you think of a surface, when we flatten it, the angle sum is going to be 2 pi, 360 degrees in the plane. And so to flatten the surface, we have three cases we want to consider. Positive curvature, where we have a cone point. And in this case, if you think of a cone point, the angle sum is going to be less than 360 degrees. So if you were to do like a projection into the plane, right, we have a deficiency of angle here. So what we need to do is we need to close the gap in these circles. So we want to decrease the radius of the center circle. If we have negative curvature or a saddle point, we have too much angle. So greater than 360 degrees. So if you were to project that in the plane, you have excess angle, so you'd have circles overlapping. So what we want to do is increase the radius of the center circle to expand things to make all our circles tangent to each other. So to do this in the Euclidean setting, basically all we're doing is using the cosine law, and what we're doing is we're creating a system of equations. So for a given vertex, right, we have an equation of the angle sum around of the circle surrounding that vertex, so to be 360 degrees, and we're trying to find the radii that will satisfy this condition across all circles. So typically what we're doing is our circle packing, and what we want to do is we want to compute the radii of, computing the radii to get our circle packing. And once you compute the radii, then it's easy to lay out your circle packing. You need to specify the location of two vertices, such as a center and a second vertex, which is, say, perpendicular, or like on the x-axis or y-axis. And once you lay out, once you specify those location of those first two circle centers, then the location of every other circle is determined, because everything must be tangent to each other. We have similar algorithms in hyperbolic geometry using the hyperbolic cosine law. Interestingly, there's no spherical algorithm. So what we do for the spherical algorithm to compute the circle packing on the sphere is we create a puncture in the surface. We use stereographic projection to project the surface down to the hyperbolic plane, and then compute the hyperbolic map, and then project that back up onto the sphere. And the other thing which is different about this method, say, compared to a lot of the numerical methods, is the numerical methods, you could, because they're computing conformal map iteratively, at each stage of the iteration, you could sort of see an intermediate map to see how the surface is, if you want, unfolding and flattening to whatever map you have. But in our case, we have the packing exists only once all the radii have been computed. So what we're doing is we're just computing the radii. We don't have any locations of any of the circles until all the radii have been computed. In the last year, though, we've been working on developing some new algorithms which are much faster and are helping us compute the spherical maps faster than previously. So the application for the setting that I'm going to talk about here is, of course, cortical flat maps on the brain. And as we know, as you've heard from many of the talks this week, functional processing occurs mainly on the cortical surface. A lot of times we're interested in 2D analysis methods, so that led to the idea of cortical flat maps and metric-based approaches such as isometric maps or area-preserving maps will always have distortion. Conformal maps, they will also have area or length distortion, but you will preserve your angles. And so they offer a number of useful properties, given that they're mathematically unique. We can work in different geometries, and we can define canonical coordinate systems. So the main advantage of flat maps using conformal maps is that they are mathematically unique, so that whatever algorithm you have and whatever algorithm I have, they will converge to the same conformal map. Whereas if you're doing some sort of area or length preserving or combination, you'll come up with your cost function, somebody else can come up with their cost function, and you'll end up with different maps. And who's to say, which map is better? Maybe in the long run it doesn't matter, but at least with the conformal maps you have this nice mathematical property that they are unique. So this will allow you to define coordinate systems, canonical coordinate systems on the cortical surface, which may be useful for comparing individual differences in cortical organization or functional foci. And of course, it can just be used as a visualization technique as well. So I think you heard on Monday already sort of the general process for mapping, flat mapping the human brain. But just to sort of recap, we'll begin with an MRI scan. The data I'm going to show is from a male human. Typically, we have resolution of 1 cubic millimeter or better in all directions. Again, the volume is stripped of extraneous regions. Pre-processing is done, such as inhomogeneity correction, perhaps registration, artifact removal, things like that. And often, then we will identify the region of interest. This could be a hemisphere, this could be a cerebellum, this could be just a small region of the brain. The resulting volume is often smoothed, and a surface reconstruction algorithm is applied to produce a triangulated mesh representing the surface of the brain. The human brain is topologically equivalent to an orientable two-manifold, so we can map that to a sphere, or often a boundary is introduced, often for a hemisphere. This is along the corpus callosum and the ventricles, by introducing cuts to make the brain topologically equivalent to a closed disk. So then you would map it into the Euclidean plane or hyperbolic geometry. Many surface reconstruction algorithms produce a surface with topological problems. These must be fixed if there are topological problems. So I'm going to go into just a brief summary of some of the topological issues that can occur. There are a number of algorithms out there that automatically that try to create surfaces which are topologically correct. But again, it's a spatial resolution which often leads to these topological problems. So a quick sort of 101 on some topology. Topological problems can be detected and repaired by examining the connectivity of the surface and using topological invariants. And the two common invariants that are used is what's known as the Euler characteristic of a surface, and it's defined to be the vertices minus the edges plus the faces of your triangulation. And then we also have the genus of a surface, and it's half times 2 minus the Euler characteristic minus m, where m is the number of boundary components of our surface. So if you have a single surface, so m would of course be 1. So if our surface is topologically correct, then it is a topological sphere if and only if the Euler characteristic is 2. And it's a topological disk only if and only if the Euler characteristic is 1. Note though that a surface that has an Euler characteristic of 2 is not necessarily topologically correct. For example, you could have two different surfaces, and one of those could have, or each of those could have a hole in them, and if you were just to do the Euler characteristic blindly, not knowing how many components you would have, you could still get an Euler characteristic of 2. So you need to check, we check typically the Euler characteristic as well as the connectivity of the surface. So types of surface problems that can occur, some of these are very simple to solve, some of these are more difficult to solve. Some of the easy ones are unused vertices. So we have vertices sitting in space, not connected to any triangle. We can get duplication of vertices or triangles. Some of these are generally very, very rare or don't occur. But often if you deal with data from sources and you don't know necessarily what's been checked, you do need to check all of these things. One of the more severe problems that can occur is non-manifold edges. So every edge in our surface must be must belong to two triangles if it's a two-sphere, or possibly one triangle if there is a boundary component. So non-manifold edges can occur if you have like a shark fin sticking up out of your surface, if you have a ridge sticking up out of your surface, bubbles, various things, weird things can occur. Surface connectivity, as I said, we only want one connected surface component. Triangle orientation, by convention, we want all our triangles to be oriented counterclockwise. That's important if you're doing things like curvature calculation. Another type of problem that can occur is a vertex singularity. So if you imagine a vertex, or sort of a balloon, and pushing it together and touching it at a single point, that would be a vertex singularity or a pinched surface. We can get holes in our surface. We want at most one boundary component where we've introduced our cuts. And then, of course, we can get handles in our surface. Handles are typically very difficult problems to solve and find, because if you think of yourself as a bug sitting on the surface, how do you know if you're sitting on a handle of the surface or the main part of the surface? We do know that each handle contributes minus 2 to the Euler characteristic. And once you find a handle, there's usually two ways to fix it. We need to cut and cap the ends off. So if you think of a donut and you take a bite out of your donut, you've now made your donut a two-sphere, as long as you bite all the way through the hole. Or we could fill in the donut, right? So if you have a solid donut, then you'd have a two-sphere as well. So some examples, these are some of the types of maps that we can generate. We can, this is example of a two-sphere mapping. So here we've got our cortical surface. Curvature is colored according to mean curvature. So of course the sulci are dark and the gyri are bright yellow or white. So here we have about 360,000 triangles. And then we can map to the plane. So in this case, what we've done is we've introduced a boundary component around the ventricles. We've left the corpus callosum. And so here we can do a mapping to the Euclidean plane, or we can do a mapping to the hyperbolic disk. Now, one of the nice things about the hyperbolic disk is that it's always this shaped. So with the Euclidean plane, right, the shape of the map will change depending upon the boundary that you specify, the radii or the edge length that you specify, whereas the hyperbolic map will always be disk shaped. We're not restricted just to a cortical hemisphere. We can map with the cerebellum. So if we isolate the cerebellum from the cortex, so here we've detached it along the brainstem, and we introduced a cut here along the brainstem. So we can do our Euclidean map. Again, the shape will vary depending upon what you specify your boundary radii to be, or we can do our mapping to the two-sphere. And this orange actually corresponds to functional data from a PET scan, and the other colors correspond to anatomical regions. So a little bit more about hyperbolic maps. So again, we've introduced our cut here along the brainstem, and so that corresponds to our boundary of our hyperbolic map. The hyperbolic maps are always disc-shaped. So one of the neat things, though, about hyperbolic maps is it has some neat property features which may be useful. So I'm sure many of you have seen this picture here by Escher, and this is drawn in the hyperbolic disk. And in this picture, each of these angles are the same area, hyperbolically. So as we progress out from the center of the hyperbolic map out to the edge is actually an infinite distance away. So of course, as we move further and further out to the edge, we're traveling a really, really long distance away, so things appear to get smaller and smaller. So we can introduce a polar coordinate system on our hyperbolic map. And one of the nice things about this feature of the hyperbolic map is we can apply these transformations, these Mobius transformations, which basically are sort of like a fisheye lens. So if you pick some other point on your hyperbolic map, so we've picked this point here, we can move that into the center of the map, as we've done here. This is still a conformal map. We're still preserving angles everywhere, but you can see how the coordinate system is affected by this Mobius transformation. So here again, things are getting all compressed up into the edge of the map, but they're expanded, giving you a nice clear view of what's going on in the center. So you can sort of think of it as looking at something under a microscope, right? It's in focus in the center, blurry around the edges, and you can move this around so that you can bring any area you want into the center of the map, because the advantage of the center of the map is even though we're in hyperbolic geometry, it looks very, very Euclidean there. And so, of course, we can start looking at flat maps of different subjects and trying to do comparisons between different subjects. Again, this is to cerebellum, and we've got the functional PET activation on these two subjects, and this is just a blow-up of the functional activation. So of course, one of the goals is perhaps to try to do registration. You could perhaps do keep a conformal template, and if you warp your other maps to your conformal template, of course you're going to lose the conformal information from those maps, but you'll have this unique map to begin with as your template. We can also use flat mapping. So some of these applications are general to any sort of flat mapping technique. We can take a highly curved region of the cortex. This region here is particularly the ventral medial prefrontal cortex and the orbital frontal cortex. And when you take this highly folded region and map it out, so again here we've preserved the length of the distance along the edges of our map, you can very clearly see, or it's much easier to demarcate the various gyri and sulci of the region. Now, one of the other things I want to talk to you about is one of the nice things that circle packing offers in terms of conformal mapping. As I said, you can specify the radii on the boundary of your maps, or alternatively, you can specify the shape that you want your conformal map to take. Now, why is that such a good thing? Well, one of the neat things is there's a number of conformal invariants that help indicate whether two maps are conformally equivalent, or at least how conformally similar they might be. And so if we specify boundary angles rather than the radii to be preserved, we can map things to different shapes, such as a triangle or a rectangle, or things like that. And if we map things to a rectangle by specifying four boundary vertices to be the corners of a rectangle, and we then look at the aspect ratio, the width-to-height ratio of that rectangle, that's a conformal invariant of our surface relative to those four corners. And it's called a conformal modulus. So it's a measure of shape, because what this tells us is that if you were to specify the same four boundary points on two different surfaces, two surfaces are conformally equivalent if and only if their conformal modulus is the same. So for example, here we have a hemisphere, and if we extract just the occipital lobe of that hemisphere, this would be our Euclidean mapping, where we specify the radii to be the edge lengths, and this is a rectangular mapping that we get where we specify four boundary corners. And so you can compute the length, the width, the height ratio to get the conformal modulus. We can take that a step further. We can do the same sort of thing with disks or annular regions. So if you extract a region out of your region and do a circle packing to get an annular region, the ratio of the radius of the outer disk to the inner disk is also a conformal modulus. So this is another measure of shape. So what you can start doing then is creating sets of measures of shape. So if you had, say, a number of different functional activation and you wanted to measure some sort of way of how they're contributing, what their shape is, I guess, to the overall surface, if you extracted those functional blobs, computed the circle packing, you can now get sets of regions that have various radii that we've computed with the circle packing, and then you can start comparing those sets across different subjects. And another neat extension of the circle packing is what we can do is we can do a metric called inverse of distance rather than circle tangency. Inverse of distance is a hyperbolic metric, and so with our general tangency packing, where our circles are tangent to each other, what we've done is we specified something on the boundary, be it the radius, the radii, or the angles that we want our conformal map to take, and then we compute the conformal map of the interior. But we're not preserving any sort of length information or area information in the interior. We have that distortion. Well, what we can compute also is this hyperbolic measure called inverse of distance, and that can be preserved everywhere in a conformal map. So although it's not a Euclidean measure, it is a hyperbolic measure that we can try of a distance that we can try to preserve everywhere. And now what inverse of distance does is we no longer require our circles to be tangent in our packing. Our circles can now overlap, or they can be separated. So inverse of distance, if we have two circles, C1 and C2, with radii R1 and R2, the general formula for the inverse of distance using conformal analysis is the cross ratio. So what this means for us is that if we are looking at an inverse of distance, if we have two circles which are tangent, that inverse of distance has a value of 1. If our circles have intersect or overlap each other, the inverse of distance will be between 0 and 1 always. And if our circles are separated, so they no longer are tangent or overlap, then the inverse of distance is going to be greater than 1. So in the Euclidean setting, we have our triangulation again with our disk. And I'm going to show some examples again where we specified the shape. So we want to have four boundary vertices. But in addition, what we're going to do is we're going to compute the inverse of distance for all our edges in the Euclidean setting using this hyperbolic measure. And we're going to preserve the inverse of distances everywhere. So in the inverse of in the Euclidean setting, the formula for inverse of distance is this, where this is the edge length between any two vertices. And to guarantee convergence, what we're going to do is we're going to specify the radii everywhere in our circle packing to be, on the boundary to be constant. So we need to specify what angles we want things to be. So this is the formula for computing the inverse of distance in the Euclidean setting. In practice, we have these maps always seem to converge and we can always compute them. Theoretically, there are some very difficult questions that are still open in terms of the existence and the uniqueness of these inversive distance maps. So, well, what does this mean? Well, if we take our inversive distance, one of the things we want to do is we want to try to converge to a conformal map. So what we can do is a refinement. So if we take a hexagonal triangle and refine it by subdividing it into four other triangles, then this scheme will converge to a conformal picture of our triangulation. So we can get some really neat pictures. So they're just from a mathematical point of view, they're really, really pretty to look at. So we have our initial, this is sort of an example of sort of some test cases to show you sort of some of the things that you can do. So we have our initial complex K. So what we're doing is we're assigning any edge that's not labeled is going to have an edge length of 1, and all the edges that are labeled will correspond, will have an angle of 15 degrees here, so we can compute the edge length. So if we specify our vertices A, B, C, and D to be the corners of our circle packing, what we are going to do is compute our first packing, and this would be the resulting map that we get. So now if we do this hexagonal refinement, if we refine it a second time and a third time, which is not shown, and the fourth time, you can now see that we're getting the conformal shape and the structure appearing in our picture. So the conformal map won't have straight lines, but because we've done the subdivision, we've got all these little tiny triangles, and of course if you blow it up, you'll see that because it's a discrete picture, we do really have all our straight lines from our triangles here, but the overall picture, you can start to see the actual conformal shape that's emerging. And if you compute the aspect ratio again here, this has a conformal modulus of 1. So that's taking the width-to-height ratio. So this one's a perfect square. So here are some other sort of test cases or examples showing what we can do. So if we have a hexagonal grid here, so I specify my four corners that I want to map to the corners in my conformal maps. So all my bold edges are going to have a length of 1.1, and my other edge lengths are going to be 1.4. And so remember I said that to converge in the Euclidean setting, we need to specify the radius of the circles everywhere. So if I specify the radius to be a quarter, so this is a contrived example to show you sort of the different types, what can happen with these different inversive distance packings. So if we take the circle radii to be a quarter, so you can see they're all going to be the same shape. And then so the inversive distance with the edge of 1.1 gives us an inversive distance of 8.6, and with the edge lengths of 1.4, we're going to get an inversive distance of 14.7. So again, inversive distance greater than 1 means the circles are now separated. So you take this hexagonal grid, this is the conformal map that emerges, so you can see the curvature of the lines in the conformal setting, and if we do a blow up here of just the center of the map, you can see that all our circles are separated. We can do, if we take our radius of our circles to be 1 over the square root of 2, using along the edge lengths now of 1.1, we get an inversive distance of 0.2, and along our other edge lengths, we get an inversive distance of 0.96. Inversive distance is less than 1, so this means our circles will overlap. Notice that the 0.96 is very close to 1, so it almost looks like your circles are tangent in some places, but they're actually not. They do overlap. So you blow up the center of the map, and you can see here that all our circles are overlapping. And again, you can see the conformal structure emerging. This is after 4 iterations of converging to conformality. And then finally, if we take the case where I take my radius of my circles to be 3/5, so now I'm going to get inversive distances less than 1, meaning the circles overlap, and inversive distance of greater than 1, so our circles are separated. We get the conformal picture emerging, and again, you can see here that in some cases our circles overlap, in other cases they are separated depending upon the edges that are curved. So of course we can apply this to brain data. This is currently one of the things we're working on. One of the ideas of using inversive distance is we're preserving more information from your original surface in your conformal map. The other thing is inversive distances and working in hyperbolic geometries give you different types of conformal information that might be useful in terms of comparing different subjects. So here, if we just take a subsurface here, a quadrilateral subsurface, and this is the inversive distance mapping, and then this is just a texture mapping using curvature to add shading and lighting to the flat map. So in the last few years, conformal maps are emerging more and more in studies of neuroscience. They've been used in studies of the hippocampus, in Alzheimer's disease, schizophrenia, and the cerebellum. A number of these papers with the hippocampus and Alzheimer's disease have come out of the Loney lab here. Some have come out of some other groups. They've also been used for cortical shape matching and looking at hemispheric asymmetry. And of course, for those of you who are interested in some of the different sensory mappings, one of the most famous models, it's not related to flat mapping, but it's the mapping of the retinotopic mapping of the visual cortex. The mapping from the visual field to the visual cortex can be modeled really quite well with a conformal map, which is very, very neat. So to summarize, circle packings are mathematically unique and converge to a discrete conformal map of a surface in the limit. We can work in different geometries, Euclidean, hyperbolic, and spherical geometries. Of course, this applies to any conformal map. They're flexible in terms of mapping to different shapes by using circle tangency or an inversive distance packings. Some of the applications where circle packing has been used is in brain mapping, but some other sort of more interesting mathematical areas is in tilings. Somebody is working on creating a coloring book for kids using circle packings, because as you can see, you can get those beautiful patterns. Dessins is an area of in conformal geometry that are sort of stick figures, and circle packings have been used there. So some open questions are regarding the existence and uniqueness for inversive distance packings. The theory has been proved for the tangency and overlap packings, but once you get into this, the inversive distance where things are separated, there's a lot of open questions still. So some of the future issues, though, in terms of neuroscience, some of these we're working on is comparing maps between different subjects using conformal metrics in brain data. You could do alignment of different regions. Is there any advantage to using conformal maps for aligning different regions? We can look at similarities and differences, and we're working on some experiments with rectangular tangency maps versus inversive distance maps. And so I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators, Ken Stevenson and DeWitt Sumners, and I have to today acknowledge my husband because he's at home looking after my six-week-old baby daughter. If it weren't for him, I wouldn't be here today. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Monica, for a really great talk. Are there any quick questions for Monica?
Okay, so this is purely a surface-based method, right? So you have to extract a surface. So you have to go from your voxel representation to your surface representation. So you do have to have some surface you're interested in, whether it's a cortical surface. Typically, in most of these images I showed, it was the gray matter, white matter surface boundary. But if you had some other surface, such as a hippocampus, that you were interested in, you could use any surface, but it does have to be a surface. It's not a volumetric method. In terms of comparisons, we've looked at some other conformal maps, mapping techniques, and compared them, and a paper came out. We had a paper in NeuroImage, I think in 2003, that looked at some of the different methods. And one of the things to point out with all of the conformal methods is that They are all quasi-conformal in the sense that once you move to the discrete setting, you need some way, there's no way to reach the conformal map in the sense of the pure mathematical sense, because that's in the continuous setting. Now, the various different techniques have various degrees of quasi-conformalness, and one of the things with the circle packing method is that you can actually put a bound on this degree of quasi-conformalness that you do have in your map. But in terms of comparing with Van Essen, what he did, or Bruce Fischel, what he's done, we haven't actually done any specific comparisons. My view is that it probably doesn't really matter in the end which method you choose, but if you're looking for some nice property, you've got the uniqueness of the conformal maps. Unless, of course, you're interested in some specific property, right? Like, there are certain regions of the cortex where you might be interested in area preserving. So, of course, then you want to use some sort of area preserving type mapping method as close as you can. So it does, like with all these methods, it does depend a little bit on your application and what you're specifically interested in. Can you repeat your first question?
Yeah, is it available as a software package?
Yes. So the package is called CirclePack, and there's a link on it to my website. It was actually developed by Ken Stevenson. So if you go to my website, I've got a link to his website to get the CirclePack software.
Any other questions for Monica?
All right, well, thanks, Monica.